Travelers often feel a sadness that as the world becomes more uniform, affluent, globalized, and modern, beautiful lifestyles, elaborate rituals, and colorful traditions will die. That's certainly happening in Asia, where in the last generation, something like a billion villagers have abandoned a life of dazzling color and ritual, where palaces were built of mud brick and houses were shared with animals and life was just like it was centuries ago, in order to join the modern parade in the urbanized world. Well, Kevin Kelly saw this coming and wanted to capture vanishing Asia with photographs while that was still possible. He began photographing Asia in 1972, and 47 years and 35 countries later, in 2019, he wrapped up the project. Kevin has completed his mission by organizing his 9,000 favorite photographs into a massive tome of 1,000 pages. It's 3 volumes in a slipcase. It's a massive trilogy that weighs 30 pounds, cost about $250 or something like that. To get lost in his work, it's a trip back in what is, to a great extent, now long gone Asia. He joins us today to tell us the hows and whys of this amazing project, Vanishing Asia. Kevin, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's a real treat. Thanks for having me, Rick. I appreciate it.
You know, it's a treat for me because way back in, I don't know, around in the late 80s or 1990 or something, when I was basically just getting going, I traveled from Seattle down to San Francisco, and I guess I was just trying to meet futurists and hippies and travelers and people with an impressive passion and a vision and who were doing amazing things. And I spent a night on your boat in Sausalito, right?
Yes, that's right. It was a houseboat at the end of the pier, South 40 Pier in Sausalito. And I was working at the Whole Earth Catalog at the time.
I remember I thought that was really cool. You're
yes.
Like an editor at the Whole Earth Catalog.
Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah, this was in the pre-digital days when we were still printing on newsprint. We were basically printing the internet on newsprint.
That was it. That was it. And it was It was pretty out there. It was sort of future reaching. But I left your boat thinking, this is a very interesting man. He's going to do some very interesting stuff. I've never interviewed anybody who's wrapping up a 47-year-long project, and it is great to have you here. Tell us, you know, why and what was your agenda with Vanishing Asia? Because you've dedicated your life to it.
It's been a side project for 50 years. I began when I was barely 20 years old, and I had never been out of New England area. You know, I grew up in the 50s and 60s in New Jersey, and I tried to convey to my kid how parochial the world was growing up. I'd never eaten Chinese food. I never held chopsticks. We didn't have Chinese around. It was just weirdly insular. And then I was invited by a friend from high school to visit him in Taiwan because he was studying Chinese to be a missionary. And I went to Taiwan, and it blew my mind. Taiwan, 1972, was a very different place. Everything was open. There was development happening right before my eyes, where I would come by and see a rice paddy and then come by a couple of weeks later and there'd be a factory there.
Yeah.
So immediately it was like, this stuff is changing so fast.
Yeah.
And everything was different. There's this different way of thinking, different way of doing, which I would completely alien to me. It was like going to another planet and then eventually like going on a time machine, going backwards. So I dropped out of college to travel, and that was my education. So instead of going to college, I went to Asia.
By the way, when you were talking about that experience in Taiwan, it reminded me, I was in some airport in Southeast Asia when I was way back then, and my flight was delayed like for 8 hours. And I just thought, well, I'll just walk away from the airport. And it's a modern airport, and I walked across the freeway and into the jungle, and there was a village, you know. The juxtaposition of that was just striking, and the contrast. And it was like one is zooming into the future and the other is getting buried by all of that progress. And
that's right.
And what you've documented over the last generation is how rapidly that's happening. I was wondering, it's Vanishing Asia. What about Africa? What about Latin America? What's special about Asia in that regard?
Yeah. I never actually really made it to Africa to travel very much there, nor South America. And I was sort of mesmerized, hypnotized by Asia. And even more so than, say, Europe. One was because it was a very, very rich culture that had a very complex set of traditions that reached all the way from the costume to the architecture to the food to how they thought, that seemed to me to be other and different. in a very rich way, not kind of a superficial way. And they had, you know, thousands of years of doing it that way. And then there was this huge diversity and variety where you could literally go over a hill.
Yeah.
And they'd be in a different language and they'd be doing things slightly different. So you keep going over the hill to the next border. And it was just this intense density of otherness. And then there was just the scale of the things. Half the people alive on this planet today live in Asia. I mean, right. it's a very, very deep well.
That stampede to the cities is depopulating the countryside. And it's just in two generations, kids don't even know what grandma did. And I mean, I see that in my European roots.
Right.
But it's even more dramatic, I think, as Asian modernizes. You capture with your photographs, you know, like just capturing timeless moments that are not timeless because they could be gone, but like Japanese moments, a monk standing silently to beg, the staffs of pilgrims outside of temples, fragile wooden homes, elegant lunches in bento boxes, food displayed in restaurant windows. That must have been really fun for you to see that there's, oh, here's something that they do in Japan. They arrange things in grids. Yes. Talk about the grids. Do you remember that page?
Yes. Yes. This is a peculiar pattern I noticed going to Japan many times is they light grids. They like to put grids on the outside of their homes, kind of the grills and bars, and they like to arrange things in grids. At a temple, they'll have all the sake barrels
grids.
Put on a grid. Or when they're hanging the little charms, temple charms, they will be on a grid. And so there was this, you know, I don't know why, but there was this pattern that they seemed to enjoy. And I was kind of recognizing and capturing that because over time, those things are disappearing.
Yeah.
And even the having shown to people who live in Japan some of my earlier photographs from Japan, they're like saying, oh my gosh, I remember that. They don't do that anymore. Like the way that they make tatami mats by hand.
I mean, you go to the Western Wall in Jerusalem or you go to some church in Europe that's filled with little messages to a saint and it's chaos. But in Japan, all the prayers are on twists of paper organized like a grid.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. there are many patterns like that. And those are just sort of baked into it. And they may not even notice it themselves until you kind of bring your attention to it. That's why I photograph. I photograph to force myself to look.
Yeah.
It's a way of forcing myself to go out and to pay attention. And the byproduct happens to be something that I can share with others to show, hey, look what I noticed.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Kevin Kelly. And Kevin has spent decades collecting photographs from Asia, all the way across Asia. And he's published it in a 3-volume collection of 9,000 photos. It's 1,000 pages of otherness in vivid and living color. It's called Vanishing Asia. And today we're learning about this project and Kevin Kelly's mission. Getting back into your just huge array of images from Asia, I love alternate transport. That's one of my favorite things about Asia more than any place I've traveled, is just there's a world of different ways to get around, and there's this sense of, yeah, there's room, hop on, you know, and colorful little 3-wheeled taxis that are powered by, like, say, a lawnmower engine, almost, it seems like, and bicycles and foot-powered pedicabs. Tell us a little bit about some of the memorable alternative modes of transportation that you featured.
Yes. Well, I will describe them, and sometimes they're kind of like tricycles that kind of built up and have an extra seat, or sidecars to a motorcycle. Right. I've taken rides, as you probably have, on tractors, farm tractors, because they may be the only vehicle in that on that area. But what's interesting to me about the reason why I kind of captured it, and maybe a larger reason to do the book, is that even though these are kind of vehicles you might only find in Asia right now, I believe that they have a little bit of a seed of an idea for our future transportation. We've seen the rise of kind of Segways trying to do something and scooters.
You see tuk-tuks in Lisbon now.
Right, exactly.
They're moving in. There's these, it's just small is beautiful in a modern world, I think.
Right, and so what I see Asia and the old ways is I am not nostalgic trying to prevent them from going away but I think there's some seeds of an idea, a design solution that we might want to pay attention to as we design the new things. So as we try to make something in between a scooter and a car, these vehicles in Asia have a suggestion of what we might want to look at.
You know, I like the idea that we have things in our heritage, teepees in the United States going back to 300 right. years. There's teepees all over the world, aren't there?
That's right. That kind of circular. Mm-hmm. I tell you, when you live in a circular room, it changes how you think about the universe. And that's something that the Aboriginals have always said. And in the modern world, we have the yurts or the gurs, they call in Mongolia, which mm-hmm. are these portable, they're kind of portable circular rooms or houses. They have a kitchen and sleeping quarters.
By the nature of nomadic lives.
That's right.
You just wrap it up. And the same thing in the Arab world. You've got these black tents, these camel hair tents that are talked about in the Bible, and they're still there today.
Exactly.
And they've got to be mobile because these are nomads. And the whole idea of nomadic life is sort of against the notion of government.
That's right.
So nomadic people are endangered like these traditions.
Throughout the world, the one exception is in Mongolia, where they have decided to try and embrace nomadism. And here's the technology that has transformed Mongolia. Not just the cell phone, which is important, it's the motorcycle.
Hmm.
People don't realize how powerful motorcycles are because you don't need roads suddenly. You can just go along a path. You can move loads, timber, market produce, bring it back. You can go up through a mountain on a trail. And what this has allowed the nomads to do is to take their kids to school.
Kevin Kelly has organized a massive photo collection, by far the largest and heaviest set of books I've ever received. It documents changes to traditions and cultures across Asia since the 1970s with some 9,000 photographs in three oversized volumes. As an early adopter of the internet, Kevin explores futurism on his website with the motto, over the long term, the future is decided by optimists. His URL is simply kk.org. You mentioned earlier that you're not romantic about this. It's not good riddance, but it's like no regrets because this is the quandary that us romantic travelers have. You want to go down to the well and see women with jugs on their heads, but they don't want to have jugs on their heads. They want to have running water in their house.
Exactly.
Right? So you made the point that, you know, a romantic old home without nails, with beautifully worked joints and so on, it's an amazing thing to behold. But it's not an amazing thing to live in. It's drafty and it's cold.
Right.
And these people quickly trade that away for a humble concrete box with Wi-Fi in a mega city of 5 million people.
Exactly. And what do they get out of that movement is something that's really intangible. So they've left their homes in these beautiful villages that have vistas of the Himalayas, and they're eating organic food, and they know who they are, and they have strong communities and strong families. It's like, what are they getting by moving into this gritty little hovel in the city? They're getting a choice in options. They can be a mathematician. They can be a web designer. They don't have to be a farmer, a blacksmith, or the farmer's wife. They actually have a choice about and a freedom to be something different. And that is so powerful. And that's why they're moving into the cities with one-way bus tickets, is because there's more choices to be something in the city. And so what we want to have is we want to keep some of that differences that these places have, the costuming. Mm-hmm. We want to retain that into the city environments as well.
Wow. It's, you know, if you were to graph change, there's always change to a certain degree, but it is skyrocketing in this last 50 years, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And there's no turning back.
There's no turning back. And so the question is, are we going to converge and diverge as we become more global? And I think at the base level, we're going to kind of converge. Most people are going to be living in, you know, square apartments with Wi-Fi and running water, wearing T-shirts and sneakers. But at the higher levels, once you have all these things provided, the kind of Maslow's hierarchy, you have the base ones all satisfied. Yep. I think people are going to diverge in what they think they're about and what they're doing and what the meaning is of purpose and what they actually spend their time on.
That's the otherness
that
you embrace. You embrace that in your Vanishing Asia project, and it's the otherness. So we can't fight modernity, but we can strive for that otherness.
Right.
Kevin, we just got a couple minutes left, and I'd like to quickly review a couple of points that I picked up from your work. You noted that different communities are at different stages in modernizing,
mm-hmm.
and you had a way to measure how far into the past a society had survived. What was your rule of thumb?
My rule of thumb was looking for whether they had retained costumes. costume, the traditional native clothing, the style, the textures and fabrics, the embroidery, was the first to go.
Okay, so there's a sequence of things that are casualties of this modernity.
Exactly.
The first thing would be elaborate costumes, because that's really, in practicality, it keeps women down and it keeps people poor.
Yes, exactly. If you think about what it took to weave cloth by hand, it's just unbelievable the amount of hours.
Yeah.
So that's the first to go. And then there's architecture, making homes. Most people made homes with stuff they could find around, whatever was indigenous materials. As we said, this can be beautiful and really harmonized, but it can actually not be the ideal living conditions in terms of air conditioning, not there, running water, not there. So we lose native and traditional architecture, second, and then we go to food, and then we can go to language.
Because languages are dying every year. People don't know it, but languages die every year.
Yes,
and
every year.
That means less diversity, less otherness, and just like small publishers can't survive, you got to be part of a big publishing house, just like you name it in whatever industry. You got to compete in the global marketplace. People want it cheap and people want it fast and people want it good. That means economy of scale, and that means uniformity, and that means goodbye otherness. Something else you noted was you could kind of measure where a society was by how much metal is being used.
Yeah. That was one of my little indicators of how remote a place was how common metal was. Wow. Usually people would have metal pots, but they may not have much more. So like, was there metal for the hinges? Was there metal being used for any of the architecture or framing and stuff? And so in the really remote places, metal was very scarce, expensive, and so there wasn't much of it. And that was like, oh my gosh, this is a time machine here, because this is like 100, 200 years ago.
You know, I'd like to just close with your thoughts on this. It's looking like the 21st century will be the century of Asia. And is that going to be with or without its rich past?
You know, I think in the last couple of years, traveling into Asia, which I do all the time, I've noticed that people have enough wealth now, they've come enough that they're now starting to think about saving and at least in a tokenized way, enough to remind people certain things. They're not bulldozing everything. They're going to bulldoze most of it, but retain some of it. So I think it's possible that Asia will continue to race into the future as fast as they are and going faster than we are in many cases, and yet look back and try to keep some of the best of what they've had from the past. I think that's happening to a small degree now and will continue to increase.
Well, congratulations and thank you for, I just love it when somebody has a passion and recognizes something and just does it. I don't know how this is going to pan out for you to monetize all of this, but you have contributed hugely. And I hope you're right. I hope that we can modernize in a smart way and not lose the otherness that you celebrate in your book, Vanishing Asia.
Well, thank you, Rick. I'm real honored to be here. Thank you.
The future may be skating on thin ice in the Alaskan Arctic, where climate changes started upsetting the balance of nature decades ago. It's the home base that Seth Kantner loves and wants you to understand as well. He's with us next on Travel with Rick Steves.